Do you have the PS one here?
I don't have it.
What did it say in the PS? This is what I got. What did it say in the PS?
You got it.
I got it? Okay.
Well, I think we're 2 minutes late, so. Bonjour tout le monde. Mesdames et messieurs, je suis David Eidelman et c'est mon honneur de vous souhaiter la bienvenue à cette occasion exceptionnelle. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome very much to the first Holmes lecture. Nous sommes très honorés aujourd'hui d'inaugurer cette série de conférences en honneur de le premier doyen de la faculté de médecine, le Dr. Andrew Holmes. Cette série de conférences a pour but de nous permettre d'inviter les plus grands scientifiques du monde et de fournir un nouveau forum pour les échanges universitaires pour l'Université McGill, nos hôpitaux et les milieux de recherche, ainsi que pour nos collègues présents ici aujourd'hui de l'Université Montréal, de l'UQAM, de l'Université Sherbrooke, de Concordia, d'IRCM et ailleurs. Pour cette première conférence Holmes, nous sommes particulièrement heureux de pouvoir souhaiter une chaleureuse bienvenue à notre invitée, la professeure Françoise Barry-Sunussi, directrice de l'unité de régulation des infections rétrovirales à l'Institut Pasteur, lauréate du prix Nobel de médecine 2008 avec le docteur Luc Montagnier pour la découverte de rétrovirus comme responsable de sida. La professeure Barry-Sunussi est reconnue à l'échelle mondiale pour sa lutte contre la maladie dans les pays en voie de développement et pour ses découvertes scientifiques. Before asking Mark Weinberg to introduce Professor Barry-Sunussi, I thought I should say a few words about the Holmes lectureship. So this lectureship is made possible by the generosity of Ruth Weiselberg. The Weiselbergs were a family in Montreal that made a number of gifts to McGill. Particularly, as I'm a respirologist, I can tell you we have a wonderful lectureship at the Chest Hospital named after Dorothy Weiselberg, the first female pulmonologist in Quebec and one of the first in Canada. But they also gave money for this lectureship, which actually launched in the 1980s under Dean Dick Kruse at the time and sustained by Dean Fuchs for a certain period. The series was hugely successful. It supported a number of fantastic speakers. The first two, if I'm not mistaken, was Professor Jacob de l'Institut Pasteur and Samuelson, some of you may have heard of, as well as Rita Levi-Montalcini, Joseph Murray, and others. Et comme c'était le cas à ce moment-là, les conférences Holmes rendent hommage à ceux qui sont des sommités dans le domaine des sciences et de la santé, tout en célébrant la mission professorale qui inspire tout ce que nous faisons, que ce soit en éducation, en recherche et en matière de services que nous offrons à la société. These lectures are to remind us of the marriage between science and the art of medicine and all our health professionals. Equally important, they open the doors to our undergrad students, graduate students, and postdocs to provide a unique opportunity to learn from an exchange with those who come to define the excellence in health sciences. And so it's great to see so many people here today. We have almost a full house. But you're wondering why Holmes lectures? Well, Holmes was the first dean of the Faculty of Medicine, as I said earlier. And he was one of the four founders of the school. He was the one who was actually interested in scholarship. I know some of my colleagues in this faculty keep emphasizing scholarship. And his major scholarship achievement was the Holmes heart, which I actually had a gross picture to show you, but I'm not going to show you. But this heart was just to show you how far we've come, this was in the 19th century, and it was a particular specimen. It was stored in the anatomical museum, and McGill was once at that time famous for its anatomical museum. And it actually formed the basis of the career of Maud Abbott, who is a very well-known professor. It was part of the start of her career and became the definitive person in the field of congenital heart disease, and was used by Sir William Osler in his book on the principles and practice of medicine. But today we're not talking about medicine at the time of when anatomical anomalies were the cutting edge, but rather we're talking about medicine in the 21st century. And so we can't think of a better person to inaugurate this series than Professor Barré-Sunacy, and I'm going to ask Dr. Mark Weinberg to introduce her.
Thank you very much, David. Merci à vous tous d'être parmi nous. Ça me fait grand plaisir de vous présenter la professeure Françoise Barré-Sunacy. Et comme vous savez tous, c'est elle qui est la gagnante du prix Nobel en médecine dans 2008 pour la découverte du VIH. Je dois vous avouer comment cette découverte a changé le monde. Parce que c'était effectivement la découverte du VIH pour pour faire possible la découverte ensuite de tous les médicaments que nous utilisons à l'heure actuelle pour contrôler la multiplication virale et le développement du sida. Donc, on peut dire avec beaucoup de justification que cette grande découverte de la part de professeur Barré-Sunacy véritablement a changé le monde, a sauvé des millions de vies à l'échelle mondiale. Et effectivement, à chaque fois qu'il y a un nouveau médicament qui est découvert, c'est toujours grâce à cette découverte dans laquelle elle a participé dans l'année 1983. Les résultats ont été publiés dans Science en 1983. Françoise est la première auteure sur ce papier qui est apparu en 1983 dans la littérature scientifique. Et je peux vous dire avec certitude que les travaux qu'elle a effectués ont été effectués par elle-même, avec ses propres mains. Il y a de temps en temps, surtout dans le système européen, autres personnes qui peuvent partager de temps en temps un prix Nobel, parce qu'à l'époque, ils ont été le directement de département. Ceci ne veut pas dire nécessairement qu'ils ont compris effectivement comment le virus peut se multiplier au même niveau que les personnes qui travaillent actuellement avec leurs propres mains, comme professeur Barré-Sunacy a fait. Et ça me fait également plaisir de vous dire que ce n'est pas la première fois que je présente Françoise à une audience scientifique. Dans l'année 2001, j'ai eu le grand honneur à l'époque comme l'ancienne présidente de l'International AIDS Society, de la présenter à Buenos Aires, en Argentine, à une conférence scientifique. Et j'ai dit à ce moment que nous devons reconnaître la personne qui a été la première auteure sur la première publication de significance, avec beaucoup de signification dans notre domaine. Et c'était elle. Françoise, to give you an idea of her dedication to our field, as Dean Edelman said, is fully engaged in efforts to do a better job for people who live in developing countries and who suffer from HIV infections. It is sad to say that although there has been huge progress, we still live in a world in which people who live in developing countries are too often not treated with the same high-quality medications that we now take for granted in countries like Canada and France and the United States. And she works tirelessly to bring about an end to the inequalities that continue to exist in this regard. And she is also very, very directly involved in her role as the current president of the International AIDS Society in these types of efforts, and also in efforts that are really designed to try to find a cure for HIV, because on a worldwide basis, the drugs are very expensive. It's very hard to ensure that everyone who needs access to anti-HIV drugs will have such access moving forward, and so she is really spearheading, as we speak, worldwide efforts that are aimed at la guérison du VIH, parce qu'effectivement, à long terme, c'est la seule solution. Il faut que nous trouvons une guérison, et donc peut-être Françoise aura d'ici je ne sais pas, 5 ans, 7 ans, 8 ans, un deuxième prix Nobel. Espérons. Espérons de toute façon que le VIH sera guéri. Donc, without further ado, let me take this opportunity to welcome Professor Françoise Barry-Sinoussi to McGill, to thank her for coming, and we all look forward to hearing her lecture. Thank you.
Merci, Françoise.
Merci, Marc. Merci, merci beaucoup. Merci, monsieur le doyen. Merci, Marc, pour ces quelques mots. C'est un véritable plaisir pour moi d'être à nouveau à Montréal. Merci de m'avoir invité pour cette conférence. C'est un grand honneur pour moi. Thank you very much. I will switch now to English. Because now in France, very soon, we will be officially allowed to speak in English at university. And as you can imagine, not everybody appreciates, but it's a conviction of our new Minister of Science, and I think this law will be accepted. Mark said that I'm now the current president of the International AIDS Society. He was before, he was a wonderful president, I must say. And it's difficult to be the president after Mark, by the way. He spoke about my engagement, but I can say that Mark was really engaged, and we all remember Mark's presidency. So, as president of the International AIDS Society, as Mark said, you know, many people think that the society is only organizing conferences. It's more than that. It's more than that because the role of the society is also advocacy. It's also to promote science and to facilitate exchanges between scientists all over the world in order to work better together. So, several years ago, before I was a president as a member of the board, we discussed with other members about the opportunity to try to accelerate research in the field of HIV cure. So, today for this lecture, I will say a few words about the novel opportunities and imperative to go and have novel therapy for the future to go towards an HIV cure. I said towards. I'm not saying on purpose an HIV cure. And I think you will understand why. So, just to start, last week Mark was in Paris with several others working on HIV/AIDS since now 30 years. And that was the celebration of the 30 years of HIV science, since, as Mark says, the first publication appeared in Science May 20, 1983. But if I'm showing you this slide, it's just to say that these 30 years of science, it's a mistake on this slide on the top, it's 30 years of HIV science, I consider myself as a very good example of translational research since the very, very beginning. We all, since the beginning, we had in mind to make science, to understand, to identify the virus, to characterize the virus, to understand better the interaction of the virus with the host. And it was also at the same time and in parallel really to develop, to develop tools for diagnosis first, tools for monitoring HIV patient before treatment and after the treatment, since the better knowledge on the virus and the interaction of the virus with the host cells, the better knowledge of the replication cycle of the virus into target cells. From that derive the development of the first antiretroviral treatment and then the antiretroviral therapy that we have today. Today, 30 years after, we are still at the same place. We still have to develop new treatment, new tools for prevention. So, of course, it has been enormous progress regarding the development of drug. The drug, as I said, has been developed according to the knowledge of the replication cycle. Today, we have more than 30 antiretroviral molecules that have been approved by US FDA. And these treatments, of course, are targeting either the reverse transcriptase, which were the first treatment indeed developed. The first one has been the AZT. Mark has been very much involved in the development and study of one of the first antiretroviral drugs, the 3TC. Thereafter, there is other drugs that has been developed in order to block other steps of the replication cycle, the protease inhibitors, the inhibitors of entry and fusion, and the inhibitors of integrase. And I must say that there is some other drugs that are currently on development to block and to increase the panel of molecules in order to block the replication cycle of the virus. This drug has been wonderful. They have been wonderful because the patients that are on treatment today, as you know, are doing well. It has decreased the mortality by more than 85%. And it has been enormous progress in access to antiretroviral treatment in resource-limited countries, as you can see on this slide. During the last years, it has been an increase of number of patients on treatment, plus 63% of people having access to antiretroviral treatment during the last 2 years. Around 8 million of persons living with HIV today are on treatment. This is certainly not sufficient. This is not sufficient. We estimate that at least twice of this number of patients should be on treatment. During the United Nations high-level meeting on AIDS on June 2011 in New York, the goal has been set to have 15 million of people on treatment by 2015. You can see on this slide also that there is only very few countries for which the coverage by antiretroviral treatment is higher than 80%. I'm glad to say that on the list, which is mentioned on this slide, you have Cambodia. Cambodia is a very, very poor country, but before of the international effort, before also of the energy and the political willingness of the country and the politician in the country, Cambodia is among these very small list of people of country where people have access to antiretroviral treatment. This is not sufficient at all, and we need to have more investment in the global fight against HIV/AIDS in order to improve the implementation of antiretroviral treatment everywhere. During the 30 years, it has been a lot of development in terms of prevention as well. In addition to the classical, let's say, preventive measure, education, usage of condom, treatment of STI, testing, counseling, arm reduction program and so on, and circumcision. Now we know that also antiretroviral treatment is an additional tool for prevention to be combined with other tools. We know that when HIV-infected individuals are on treatment, they're less transmitted to others. A large study on serodiscordant couple have shown that if the seropositive partner is treated by antiretroviral treatment, then you decrease by more than 95% the risk of transmission to the partner who is seronegative. So treatment can be used, is also one tool for prevention. For also a prophylaxis, we can use also antiretroviral treatment today. And you know that in the United States, it has been decided to propose Truvada as prevention for high-risk population like MSM. It's now on the market. Your usage also of new version of microbicide gel containing antiretroviral treatment have shown by several studies to be efficient. The first study was a Caprisa 004 showing a decrease of more than 30%, 39% of the control of transmission by the women that were using the gel. However, other studies show are less efficient and show that how much adherence is important to use and this antiretroviral treatment approach for prevention. On this slide, there is two red boxes. The two red boxes is two missing tools for prevention for the future. The vaccine, of course, and HIV cure. So now I will move on HIV cure and why we need to have novel strategy. First of all, HIV/AIDS, as you know, remains a major global health challenge. Mark says that. We have 2.5 million of new infections every year. We still have more than 1.5 million of deaths every year. And Mark says that we have to ensure equitable access to prevention, treatment of care. We know that globally, around 50% of people that are HIV positive do not know their positive status. We have to fight against the stigma and discrimination. This is critical in order to improve access to testing. We need to improve the access to all available antiretroviral treatment, including the second and the third line of treatment. But you know that indeed this second and third line of treatment are 2 to 15 more expensive than the first line treatment. We still have too many children infected by HIV, and only around 50% of HIV pregnant women in the developing countries are receiving the treatment to prevent the transmission to their babies. This situation is really unacceptable when we know that we can prevent mother-to-child transmission since now the 90s. We need to improve the quality of care, monitoring of the patient in the developing world. We need to continue the training of health professionals and to better organize and decentralize the health system. This is one of the priorities for the future, urgent need to further implement the current tools that we have. But we know that we have to develop novel strategy, and we will not have novel strategy if we don't make science. So why do we need a novel therapeutic strategy? It's obvious by what I said about the too few countries that have more than 80% coverage of antiretroviral treatment. We know also that this treatment is lifelong. And lifelong, that means that we have, for the people living with HIV, when you discuss with them, still substantial stigma and discrimination on treatment. When you ask them, like I do, when I do go to developing country in Africa or in South Asia, I used to ask them, you are on ART, you are doing well. What are you expecting from us, the scientists? And they all say, we would like a treatment that we can stop. We know that it's difficult for them on long term to be adherent. We know also that the life expectancy on heart is still reduced. And we know that we have still a significant morbidity on heart due to the development of complications on long-term heart in a small proportion of patients, developing between 8 and 10% of people living with HIV, developing cancer, developing aging disease, cardiovascular disease. So we need certainly to have new strategy, and we know, as I said before, that if we have new strategy, it will be also a tool for prevention. We need a novel strategy because we have an increasing number of patients in the developing countries that are in need for the costly second line and third line regimen. As I said before, the estimated cost to reach the 2015 United Nations goal of 15 million of people living with HIV and ART, it's about $22 billion. And we know that probably we need to put more patients on ART than 15 million of people living with HIV, since we certainly have to treat earlier than we thought. This long-term cost of lifelong ART is in a situation today of a global economic crisis with limited investment from the developed country. So certainly this is the arguments to think about a novel strategy for treatment for the future. The question people ask me very often, why it's time to accelerate HIV cure research now? Certainly it's better because we have a better knowledge on HIV pathogenesis, and we accumulate this knowledge during the 20 years of HIV science. We know that indeed the outcome of HIV infection is mainly due to the establishment very early on of a viral reservoir and the establishment of a persistent infection and probably remaining low level of replication even on heart, at least in some tissue. We know that very early on after the exposure of the virus, we have an inflammation, and to this abnormal inflammation, it's the establishment of chronic immune activation, and we know that both are interacting. We know that probably inflammation is playing a role and activation is playing a role on the remaining activation, and the presence of the virus is also inducing inflammation and abnormal immune activation. Why do we need lifelong ART? We all know today that is because the HIV infection is persisting on ART, and this is clearly shown on this slide, where you can see that if one patient stop the treatment is of ART, then there is a viral rebound. And we know that this viral rebound is due to the fact that we can detect the latent infection, as you can see here, by detecting HIV DNA in the patients. We know that the number of patients with undetectable DNA is very rare, if not to say absent. And we know that the barrier for an HIV cure is indeed is the fact that we have these latently infected cells, the fact, as I said, that we have residual viral replication, which is probably related to the inflammation and immune activation, the fact that we have a reservoir in the different tissues, and the fact also that ARV penetration into different tissues is not sufficient. Why it's time to accelerate HIV cure now? It's because also we accumulate during the last years a series of information. First of all, there is a proof of concept of from the Berlin patient. You know, this patient that was HIV positive, and was on heart, developed a leukemia, and was decided to treat this patient by a bone marrow transplant of a special donor having a mutation in one of the receptors of HIV, the CCR5, the famous Delta 32 mutation. And so he received this bone marrow transplant, but he received also, when you receive bone marrow transplantation, he receive also immunosuppressive drug and a very, of course, very difficult treatment. But this Berlin patient today has undetectable virus in his body. We have the HIV controllers. The HIV controllers are those very rare individuals, less than 0.3% of people living with HIV. They never receive any treatment. They are infected for more than 15, 16, 17 years for some of them now. They are doing perfectly well. And they naturally control their infection. They have undetectable viral load. They have low level of viral reservoir. We have also the cases of what we can call functional cure after very early treatment. There's a case of the Mississippi baby. Mississippi baby, we still wonder whether it's functional or a cure. The Mississippi baby, it's a baby that has been treated 30 hours after birth for 18 months. 6 months of control off of treatment. Indeed, this Mississippi baby is born from, she's a girl, she's born from a mother that was not on heart. So the baby was treated, was positive at birth and was treated very early on for 18 months. Her mother stopped the treatment, and when she came back, indeed, the doctor found out that we could not detect the virus in the baby. We have in France patients that we call Visconti patients. I will say a few words about that. But this 14 patients that has been treated very early on after infection for 3 years, they stopped their treatment and they are doing perfectly well with undetectable viral load and the low level of reservoir as well. We have also monkey model, different monkey model. Here on this slide, I indicate natural protection against AIDS in African non-human primates infected by HIV. And we know that this lack of disease progression is related to an attenuated immune activation in those monkeys, related to the lack of microbial translocation with absolutely no destruction of the gut. We know that there is a restriction of their infection, of the infection of the memory CD4 T cell related to a lower expression of CCR5. We know that there is this innate immune response to SIV in those monkey, in particular at the level of the plasmacytoid dendritic cells and type 1 interferon, and particularly type 1 interferon stimulated gene. So this is also a model where we know how bad can be inflammation and immune activation. But there are also other models, like the monkey vaccinated by CMV as a vector for a vaccine for HIV. And again, the group of Louis Picker showed by using this model that indeed it can have a functional cure somehow with a monkey that are showing a decrease of infection. So we have different reasons today to think that a cure, at least functional one, should be possible. The Berlin patient, as I say, and remember you on this slide, is the first proof of concept for a functional cure. But there is others now report in the literature. I mentioned here on this slide the data from the group of Kuritskes reported last year with similar treatment of bone marrow transplant in two patients who were presenting Hodgkin lymphoma. Those patients were transplanted, but with a donor without the Delta 32 mutation, and they were on heart, continuous heart. After more than 2 years of follow-up, there is no detection of the virus in the PBMC, in the peripheral mononuclear cells of the patient. The viral DNA is becoming undetectable, and there is a decrease, even a decrease, of the antibodies, like if they were becoming seronegative. So that indicates that indeed this bone marrow transplant per se may play a role by itself without the mutation in Delta 32, raising the question why the Berlin patient has no detectable virus today. Is it due to the mutation Delta 32? Is it due to other mechanisms, in particular the bone marrow transplant, the immunosuppressive drug? This is a question that we certainly have to answer. There is, by the way, an additional patient, we call it now the Bethesda patients, similarly receive a bone marrow transplant and with similar data. Learning from the controller, what did we learn from the HIV controller? We know that they do not have a defective virus. We know that there is a genetic background for sure, because most of them, in most of them, there is an overrepresentation of the HLA B27 and B57 protective allele. We know that in relationship to this genetic background, there is in a significant proportion of them a strong CD8 T cell response, which is capable to eliminate the infected cells. And we know that, as you can see on this slide, the level of the DNA, the level of latently infected cells, is very low in these elite controllers compared to patients on heart or to the long-term progressor. So the HIV controller clearly are able to have achieved and have an extremely weak HIV-1 reservoir, and which is remarkable is that they are capable to maintain over the time this low level of reservoir. We know also that a proportion of elite controllers, their target cells, both the macrophages, as it is shown here, have a reduced susceptibility to HIV infection, and this is true also for their CD4 cells, which show a reduced susceptibility to HIV infection. So we don't understand clearly why. There is clearly an early block of the reverse transcription in the cell, in the cells of the elite controllers. There are an upregulation of P21 that has been reported in the literature in the CD4 cells of these elite controllers. But this the reduced susceptibility to HIV of these cells is not associated to the P21 level at the time of infection, and certainly it's not it cannot explain the reduced susceptibility in macrophages. We know that these elite controllers, as I said before, at a very low level of DNA, and what it has been reported by one of my collaborators, Azier, it has been capable to show that the low level of DNA in this elite controller is clearly related to and correlate to the low level of DNA, as you can see on this slide. The low level of replication correlates with the low level of reservoir cells. So this is clearly a model somehow for functional cure. But of course, it's very difficult to understand what's going on during the early phase of infection in elite controllers. And now we have in our hands SIV model, SIV controller, and we are trying to understand more precisely the mechanism, particularly during the early phase of infection. Very early treatment as a strategy to control HIV reservoir. This is the Visconti study. Visconti's name is corresponding to virological and immunological study in controllers after treatment interruption. We call them also post-treatment controllers. As I said, we have 14 patients treated very early, an average of 10 weeks after HIV infection, for a median of 3 years. They have control of the viral load, with undetectable viral load, for a median of 7 years, more than 7 years today, after they stop their treatment. We cannot find the same genetic background than the one in the controller. They are not B57, B27. We cannot find the strong CD8 response. Even they have a weak CD8 response compared to what has been reported to the controllers. So the mechanism is not clearly known, but what we can say, and that is shown on the different figures on this slide, is that the post-treatment controller at very low level of cell-associated DNA, as you can see here on this slide, after treatment interruption. And what is surprising is that even over time, the level of cell-associated DNA is decreasing, as you can see here. So an early and prolonged therapeutic intervention can indeed favor the control of the infection. What are the mechanisms? We don't know, as I said. It's not the CD8 response, this is clear. We are trying to understand what are the mechanisms. Which kind of HIV cure are we looking for? Of course, when we speak about cure, generally we are speaking about eradication. That means a sterilizing cure. That means that we will have to eliminate all HIV-infected cells in all the different compartments and to have an undetectable viral load. More or less is to reproduce the Berlin patient post bone marrow transplant. We are, this is, I must say, very difficult, if not to say impossible. So what we are in particular looking for, it's a remission after, without a treatment, off of treatment. What was Tony Fauci called functional cure. That means a long-term health without antiretroviral treatment, with no detectable viral load, more or less to reproduce the elite controllers or the post-treatment controllers. So it's the reason why it's so important to understand why, how the Berlin patients, the elite controller, or the post-treatment controller are able to achieve this long-term control of their HIV reservoir. Why it's time to accelerate HIV cure research now is also because we have a better knowledge on HIV reservoir in many cell subsets and tissue. We know that the reservoir is persistent and stable even after 10 years of ART. We know that the CD4 T cell latency is rare. We estimate between 10 to the 6 resting CD4 cells. We know today that the reservoir, the major reservoir of HIV-1 are the resting central and transitional CD4 plus memory T cells. And we know that the latent infection is not only reported in the naive, in the resting T cells, but also in other cells, in astrocytes, in hematopoietic progenitor cells. And the reservoir, the anatomical reservoir, are several of them. We have the gut, we have the genital tract, all the lymphoid tissue, and we have to consider also the central nervous system. We are far to know all the subset of cells that are used as reservoir. But we are making progress in that area during the last years. We have a better knowledge as well on the persistence of latently infected cells. We know that this persistence is due to the survival of these cells, but also to the homeostatic proliferation of these cells. And there are immune mechanisms that are maintaining the cells in a resting state, and that is contributing by itself by the persistence. For example, we know that there is an upregulation of PD-1 in the latently infected cells, and this is an important observation that may be used also for treatment for the future. Also, we have to consider that PD-1 is not only expressed on the resting CD4 T cells. Why it's time to accelerate HIV cure research is also because we have certainly a better understanding on the molecular mechanism of HIV latency. This slide is quite complicated, and I'm sure you cannot see it on the back of the room, but let's say just a few words. We are understanding more and more all the cellular factors that are explaining the latency. We know that the latency involves many factors and interaction between cellular factors that block the transcription. We know that we have to consider HDAC as one of the mechanisms, and for that today is a reason why there is HDAC inhibitors that are already studied for cure. We know that we have to consider also the transcription elongation factors. We know that all these partners have to, and this complex between cellular factors that block the transcription has to be considered for the future of NHIV cure. Scientific imperative, other scientific imperative, we know that of course we have to stop the remaining HIV replication, but also the spreading to non-infected cells if we reactivate the reservoir cells. We certainly probably will have to control abnormal inflammation and immune activation as well, and we will have to eliminate the reactivated infected T cells by enhancing the host immune response. Reactivating the latent reservoir, we have to play on all the factors that we know today are very important to block the transcription. There are NF-kappa-B activators like prostatin, like PMA or TNF-alpha, the HDAC inhibitors that I mentioned, and several studies has been made and are ongoing using vorinostat. We can think about activating the receptors through the JAK-STAT pathway using molecules like IL-7. Jean-Pierre knows very well this topic. We can use AKT, Exim-1 modulator. We have other molecules like methylation inhibitors. In methylation, it's an important step for the chromatin structure as well. And this is new approaches used by some people to purge the latent reservoir. And of course, to reactivate the cells. The question is whether after reactivation the cell will die, and indeed we are starting to have the answer, the cells are not dying. So that's the reason why certainly we will have to combine two other treatments. Regarding the study of vorinostat in a patient on heart, the first data reported was the data of David Markolis, reported in Nature in 2012, demonstrating for the first time that latency can be reversed by HDAC inhibitor. But since then, there is other data, the data of Sharon Lewin, and now there is another study reported with a more potent HDAC inhibitor in Denmark using the panobinostat. So the field is moving this day, but there is also a new approach that have to be considered, gene therapy. Gene therapy approach to try to reduce the size of the reservoir and to avoid the spreading at the same time. I like to mention, of course, the use of the single finger nuclease using an adenovirus vector in order to block and to make the cells resistant by to the infection because of the resistance to CCR5. We have to think about using other approach in gene therapy like silencing their RNA, silencing the expression of the receptors in order to avoid reinfection of cells. Reactivation will not be sufficient, and of course immunological strategy for immune reconstitution, but also to stimulate the immune response have to be considered. Up to now, I must say that those approaches, as well as the vaccine therapy, has not been very, very successful. I mentioned that we certainly PD-1 is expressed on the resting cells, and maybe we have to think about treating by PD-1. But this is a question today, whether we should move on. Of course, this kind of treatment has been used in other diseases. Whether we have to move, there are studies going on in different models in order to know whether we are moving in that field. I like to say that therapeutic vaccination has not been very successful today, except what I mentioned for Louis Picker and his CMV vector for HIV vaccine, where he is clearly inducing a very efficient memory CD8 response capable to control the infection in a monkey, and certainly it's an approach to consider to be associated with other approach for cure. Just one word also. One word on neutralizing antibody or on protecting antibody. There is more data that indicates that maybe we will have to use antibody as well associated to cure or to a drug to reactivate the latent reservoir. Other scientific imperative, certainly we don't have to forget that we may need to target the myeloid lineage, including in the host tissue, and we certainly will have to enhance the cell and tissue drug delivery and penetration into reservoir cell and tissue. So that means that we will have to learn in the coming year from the ongoing preclinical and clinical trials. We certainly will have to develop studies in animals, in particular in primate models, in order to move on future clinical trials. What are the future strategies? Some of them has been already used. Treatment optimization and intensification to try to eliminate all the remaining replication of virus. Up to now, it has not been very successful, but there is other studies going on, like the OptiPrim study, in order to optimize the treatment and intensify the treatment, but early on, early after infection. As I said, the second approach is to reverse the latency by reactivating the latently infected cells. Immune therapy, even if it has not been very successful today, some of this approach is certainly an approach to be used to reverse the pro-latency signaling. Therapeutic vaccination, I already mentioned, and gene therapy to make cell resistance to HIV infection. Certainly for the future, we already know that we will need a combined approach. We need a combined approach based in particular on this study published by the group of Bob Siliciano last year, showing that using HDAC inhibitor alone in an in vitro model is not sufficient, and that we will need to associate the treatment to the stimulation of the CD8 response in order to eliminate the reactivated T-cells. So a combination of a different cure approach may be needed in the future, reactivation plus question mark. The reason why, as I said, we decided at the International Society to try to accelerate the work and the science on this field. This initiative was launched in 2011. The idea is to try to have an alliance, and we decided to first have a multidisciplinary group of scientists to develop and to define a global scientific strategy with a key priority for science. And indeed, Jean-Pierre was part of this group. Oops. Again. Thank you. The group has defined a global scientific strategy that was published last year in July in Nature Review in Immunology. And in this paper, the group reported seven priorities that we can summarize, let's say, in three direction. The first direction is certainly to continue to better understand the mechanisms that are controlling HIV persistence, both at molecular, cellular, and immunological level. The other direction is to develop new assays and experimental models to detect and measure the viral reservoir, both in tissue and in cells, in patients on heart. This is really critical. This is a point that we start to measure how weak we are today with the technique that we have. We need to continue to develop and evaluate new therapeutic tools and an immune strategy as well in order to get this remission in absence of antiretroviral treatment. So this strategy today has to be implemented, and that needs a strong collaboration at international level. Another critical imperative for this HIV cure is certainly to better coordinate the science at international level, and it's the reason why, in parallel to this scientific strategy, it has been decided to have an advisory board with a representative of the main agencies, stakeholders involved in HIV. And you can see on this slide that our board is, in our board, we have a representative of the NIH, of course, representative of UNAIDS, representative of AMFAR, the Chinese CDC, is present in the board, as well as representative of the Department of Science and Technology of South Africa. We have also representative of Canada, of course, and I'm glad that since we launched this initiative, the Canada decided to have a priority, as priority, HIV cure research. Other critical imperatives that are not really scientific, but it's linked to science as well. We need really to have the community engagement. As I said before, clearly people living with HIV are expecting a novel therapeutic strategy for the future. But what are they expecting? What are they ready to accept? Which kind of strategy they will accept to be tested? I mean, this is a critical issue. It's more social science, let's say, but it's very important to be done at the same time that we are doing science. We need to have the engagement of pharmaceutical companies in order to work together. For the combined approach, it's clear that we need a cooperation between private sector, but we need also the private sector to work with the academic. There is ethical issue and regulatory body engagement that are needed. Of course, the cure strategy that we are thinking about, it could be benefit, but it could be a risk as well. So we have to consider all these ethical issues of this novel therapeutic approach. Cost effectiveness, it's also an imperative. It will not be acceptable to have a novel therapeutic strategy that will not be affordable for the developing country. Finally, I like to say that for me, cure and vaccine research cannot be separated. We are, both of them are priorities, and certainly for HIV cure, we certainly need to make progress in vaccine research as well. Altogether, what is proposed today is to have an integrated approach. As I said before, we need to have a better scientific cooperation and coordination between the funders. We need to have better exchanges and data exchanges between the scientists all over the world. We need to have better interaction between basic and clinical science. We need cooperation between the public and private sector and the community engagement. We need new concepts as well and new generation of scientists working together. We need also to work with others, others that are not working in the field of HIV. If I'm saying that, it's because indeed last week, at the beginning of the week in Paris, we have the first meeting together of HIV and non-HIV researchers. I told you that HIV disease is characterized by the establishment and the persistence of HIV infection in relationship with abnormal inflammation. We know that many other diseases are related to inflammation. Of course, I mentioned on this slide cancer and lymphoma, aging disease, cardiovascular disease. Last week, we have a very productive meeting with people working on cancer, people working on aging disease, people working on autoimmune disease, cardiovascular disease, and other also latently infection like herpes simplex or HTLV-1. I think it has been very productive. We know that some of the drugs that are already used for HIV cure, like the HDAC inhibitor and so on, are drugs that are used in cancer. And I think that by working together, we certainly will progress faster. Finally, of course, the scientific group has defined a scientific strategy, a roadmap for the future. But we have to continue to work together. And today, at the IAS, we have the different working group. We have the industry collaboration group with experts. Working in basic science and clinical science together with pharmas. We have a group on cost effectiveness. We have a group on social science with representative of community. We have an ethics working group. We are now working at the IAS for improving information and exchanges with a database that will be available to all. We have these new exchanges between HIV and non-HIV researchers, and we have a board which is really committed today. And I'm sure that we will make progress in the future. The next step will be the symposium in Kuala Lumpur, where we will all meet again together to see what are the progress that has been made in the field of towards an HIV cure. And now you understand if I say towards an HIV cure, it's because we are speaking more about remission of treatment than speaking about eradication. I like to acknowledge indeed all the member of the IAS toward the HIV cure working group, in particular Steve Dix, Sharon Lewin, who has been very, very active, the IAS staff, Marika Penico, and now, since Marika left, Anna-Laura Ross and Rosanne Langplouf, and of course my assistant, Olivier Rescanier. Thank you for your attention.
Merci beaucoup, Françoise. Professeur Barry Sinoussi est maintenant prêt à accepter des questions que vous en avez. Questions?
I'll speak loudly. With all due respect to the wide-ranging scope of the presentation, may I suggest that we add another reason why it's important to work for a cure, namely the prevention of possible abuse. As more and more people, including many scientists, are becoming to believe that the world is unsustainably overpopulated, chances are that certain groups will receive less attention than others. And I would suggest, given the kind of prejudiced world in which we live, chances are that HMV will not be at the top of the list receiving the greatest amount of funds or attention. So it seems to me that if we want to prevent great abuse, we should work faster now.
I agree. Totally agree.
Thanks very much. I just wanted to ask about the strategy of the International Society. I saw the working groups on ethics and industry collaboration, and I was wondering if you thought that it would be a good opportunity for the organization to work with the public institutions to ensure that when new treatments are discovered, that we have licensing strategies that are not exclusive for a 20-year period, so that in the future we don't have a $22 billion price tag to increase our treatment of people, and maybe we can look at using non-exclusive licenses or licenses that have 5 or 10 year expiry dates to ensure that, you know, we're paying reasonable costs to treat these people in the future.
The question you raise is exactly what the group is discussing. And of course, in that group, let's say it's mostly scientists working in private company. And of course, they are very open to collaboration between themselves and between themselves and the academic. However, and this is what mostly, let's say, my role and the role of Jack Weiskauer, the director of Office of AIDS Research at NIH, is to now go to the CEO of the company. Because the scientists working in the company, and they are already working together with the academics, some of them, like Daria from Merck. But they say, you have to help us. You have to help us and to convince our CEO. And of course, there's a problem of intellectual property. Of course, there is all this problem. But we will make advocacy and we will do our best to move on all the problems you raised. It's not easy, we know. It's not an easy task. But look, in the past, it has not been an easy task as well for making the drug, the cost of the drug to decrease. It has not an easy task for the intellectual property, for the development of generic and so on. So we think we can move on, and we will do.
Thank you very much for your great talk and for the lovely overview. I was hoping perhaps you could comment maybe very briefly on the role of subtype diversity and how that may influence our efforts towards the cure.
I did not mention that because I know that you are very much involved here in Canada and that in Montreal in particular. Of course, this is one thing to consider. And is part, of course, of the new strategy that has been developed to make sure that it's efficient for all the subtype. And you have drug already that have been shown to be more efficient on certain subtypes than others. The classical antiretroviral drug and the new one that are on development. And of course, this we have to check, and this is on the list.
Pierre? You think the vaccine, effective vaccine will come first or an effective cure?
I have no magic bullet, so I don't know. I don't know at all. It's a therapeutic vaccine, you know, better than myself, but it has been very deceptive up to now, except what I mentioned for Louis Speaker, which is quite promising. But, and there is data now regarding neutralizing antibodies that I have heard and seen some data that are very promising as well for usage as cure, let's say, combined to other approach. It's difficult to say what will be first. I think we need to, for cure anyway, we will need to combine both. I don't think we will have only one approach. We have to have a combined strategy.
Nous allons prendre ces deux dernières questions.
I have a question about the strategy from the International AIDS Society, because by reactivating, one of the strategies to reactivate the latent reservoir, but don't you think it's very risky for the patients? Because if I think currently we don't know if we are going to eliminate or kill the cells when you reactivate. So don't you think that there is a big risk to reinfect new cells?
It's the reason I mentioned that reactivate alone will not work. You have to combine.
So do we have
to? We have to combine to vaccine, to therapeutic vaccine, or you have to combine with other approach in order to avoid the virus to spread again. Because we know from the data of Siliciano already that, for example, the HDAC inhibitor, the HDAC inhibitor, that's reactivated in vitro is not sufficient, and they have shown that in vitro you need to have CD8 cells to eliminate the reactivated cells. So again, we don't believe in only one treatment to reactivate the cells will be sufficient. That could be risky if we don't associate to other approach.
Do we have evidence that we can't believe that it could work? No?
We have to do it. If you don't do it, you will never know. There's a reason why we have to develop, as I said, in my opinion, but that was the opinion of the group also, to make more studies in animal models, because it will be very complicated to make clinical trials. You know, the clinical trials, you have first to take one strategy separately and then to combine. So if at the same time we have can start to have data from studies in animal models. Of course, the animal model will not give the final answer. We will have then to go to clinical trials, but at least it can be very informative about the combination of strategy, which type of strategy we have to combine with the others.
Professor, I have a question about the people you called controllers, whether naturally occurring or induced by early treatment. On a practical level, are they still infectious, whether sexually or bloodborne?
On the practical level, I must say that they have a very low, undetectable viral load. We cannot say that they don't transmit at all, but they are in the situation of where the risk of transmission is very, very low. cannot say zero, but it's very low since they do not have detectable viral load in the blood. For some of them also, it has been shown that the viral load in the genital secretion, for example, is undetectable as well.
Thank you.
Merci, Françoise. We'll now turn it back to our dean, Dr. Edelman.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Et merci beaucoup. Of course, thank you very much for that fantastic lecture, and thank you very much for the taking the time to answer these questions. We have people may know that tomorrow Professor Barry Sunusi is going to receive an honorary degree as part of our convocation ceremony. But even in anticipation of that, we have a small token to commemorate this as the inaugural lecturer in the home series. Alors, félicitations et merci beaucoup.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Merci beaucoup. Merci. Alors, on va sortir. Thank you
very much, everybody.